This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Did you hear about Operation Pangea 2, Interpol's global action against illegally manufactured and internet-distributed drugs and devices? Didn't think so. More than 100 countries collaborated to identify offending operations and websites. In 1 week, nearly 20,000 packages of illegally distributed prescription drugs were confiscated worldwide. Here in the U.S., agents from the FDA and Customs and Border Patrol swarmed mail facilities and seized packages on their way to American customers. With no prescriptions and plenty of risks. Atlanta-based physician and journalist Ford Vox found a report citing one big American retailer that is profiting from the sale of prescription and illicit drugs, Amazon. We found Ford's article, Amazon's Illegal Drug Dealing, on Slate.com. Ford Vox, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me on. I'm delighted to talk about this story with you.
Well, first, more on the raid of facilities in L.A., Chicago, and New York on May the 22nd. Government agencies would not reveal to you if they'd seized anything from an Amazon mail center, but you have some reporting and some anecdotal evidence of prescription drugs sold on Amazon, thanks to your wife.
That's right. Well, I'll get to my wife first. You did point out about Operation Pangea. It is quite interesting that along with, as organized by Interpol, our federal government agencies have been engaged in kind of a regular sweep of kind of the detritus of internet websites out there that are shipping American consumers all sorts of things that are illegal, that wouldn't be legal even with a prescription, and also a lot of prescription drugs. And that's something that kind of we're all aware of in the back of our minds, that there is a lot of dark and dirty stuff out there on the internet, a lot of dangerous things. But Amazon.com we think of as a rather fine, upstanding American company. It actually employs over 100,000 people. This story came to light because of a product that Amazon shipped to my own home that my wife had purchased. I was not aware until this product arrived, which was a prescription antibiotic, that Amazon was somehow a pharmacy. And indeed, through my reporting, I found out that they're not a pharmacy, and they're doing this illegally. My wife actually ordered this prescription drug to treat her own acne. She did have an acne problem, not an uncommon scenario, but it wasn't responding to her kind of normal skin care. And she was looking around Amazon for different products that she hadn't tried before. Amazon served her up something that was actually illegal.
It was called Vitara Clinda Gel, if I'm even pronouncing that properly.
That's right. The antibiotic my wife purchased was clindamycin, again marketed as Vista Clinda Gel. When the package arrived to her, it seemed somewhat more pharmaceutical than she expected. And then she asked me, is this a prescription antibiotic? Of course, it was. It's a prescription antibiotic that actually we don't take lightly in the hospital. It's something that we know can actually cause a deadly gut infection called C. diff. And it's something that some people have a violent skin reaction to called Stevens-Johnson syndrome. It's a powerful antibiotic that really physicians should look after.
Which other kinds of drugs did you find available on Amazon?
Just in terms of my short amount of time I spent searching, I was able to find another prescription antibiotic being advertised to use for urinary tract infections called norfloxacin. I actually found a controlled steroid drug in some of my reporting. I also found that there was a muscle relaxant on the website known as Robaxin in the United States or methocarbamol that can be somewhat sedative, can even give a mild high. When mixed with alcohol, it can be deadly. And I found that there actually been prior reporting about some of the steroids, some of the anabolic steroids that were available in supplements on Amazon.com. And I was surprised to learn that Amazon has previously taken down some of those types of substances when they've been pointed out on their website, but then they'll pop back up again.
Wouldn't it be kind of easy to monitor Amazon, just see what's up and down? I'd like to know which agencies police Amazon and why it's getting away with violating current laws and selling banned substances.
Well, that's really what's somewhat remarkable to me is, we do have a number of federal agencies that have some degree of oversight over certainly all American companies with regards to commerce and pharmaceuticals. And a lot of these agencies are engaged in big operations like Operation Pangea, and they're attempting to intercept individual packages that are coming from some of these, kind of dark internet websites. It's very difficult to police. If you think about it, there are thousands of these packages being delivered overnight to shipping centers across the United States. What we need in the case of something like Amazon is somebody to put two and two together and say, hey, where is a lot of this stuff coming from? It seems to be coordinated by particular hubs or networks or kind of cogs in a central system. Amazon is certainly one of those major hubs. One of the things that I pointed out in the story is it should be pretty easy to enforce or police Amazon. This is a company that's easy to contact. Really, they've just got to tell Jeff Bezos that, look, you've got to spend a little bit more money here, perhaps hire some more people to look at the products that are on your website.
We're talking about the proliferation of illicit drugs that are available online. The Silk Road may be out of commission, but as our guest Ford Vox discovered in reports by several different sources, there is plenty available on Amazon's online marketplace. Ford, you write about findings by the Banned Substances Control Group, and this reporting was picked up by The Washington Post, Forbes, and now Slate. They found evidence that Amazon was selling banned substances, but the FDA chose to go after the third-party seller instead. What happened there?
That's right. Actually, just a few years ago, there was a rather large fine levied against another website called bodybuilding.com. The FDA got wind of the fact that there were quite a few banned substances being sold through that website. That fine, which was rather large, of course, it would represent a micro fraction of a day of Amazon's business. It was a $7 million fine. The CEO of that company, or president of that company, actually received a fine personally of about $600,000 over this. But one of the sources I spoke with for the story documented up to 2 years prior to FDA's action against bodybuilding.com, those same substances were available for sale on Amazon.com, and they were also for sale on Amazon after that action.
So I guess the question is, how involved is Amazon with the third-party sellers that it works with? You spoke to a representative from Amazon. What did they say about this?
I asked some very specific questions. I did finally get Amazon's PR on the phone and went through all my questions. Each question was pretty much a no comment. However, they did point me to a counterfeiting policy that they have, kind of an anti-counterfeiting policy. Basically, the policy lists that for their sellers, that if you sell something on Amazon that is illegal or counterfeit, you're responsible for that. We will cancel your seller's account. We may even hold the funds that are due to you. And I think through that policy, it kind of demonstrates that Amazon is trying to distance itself somewhat through these third-party sellers. However, Amazon has a very close business relationship with those people who either pay monthly or annual fees and a significant percentage of what they're selling. For example, the products that we're talking about in that category of kind of health and beauty products, Amazon is taking 15% of that. And it's not like Amazon can claim to be, for example, an eBay that's bringing people together that are then going to handle the rest of the transaction themselves. No, Amazon is actually processing the card payments, and you remain an Amazon customer, and Amazon is taking out their cut and then actually transferring the rest of the funds to the bank account of the original seller. Really, this is very much the online equivalent of a Walmart, for example, and they have much more responsibility with what's going out to people's homes.
Well, of course, Amazon has come under a lot of criticism for its conduct in the bookselling business. There's a recent battle that it's been having with Hachette. Let's just say a reputation for not playing well with others. Is Amazon too big to tackle, do you think, Ford?
I think there's some legitimate questions to be raised there. Certainly Amazon has lobbyists. Amazon is a major player in the American economy at this point. Its owner recently purchased the Washington Post. There are definite difficulties with trying to regulate something the size of Amazon. It employs over 100,000 people. Its business raked in over $70 billion last year. So it's not something that can be lightly regulated. If they do receive a letter from the FDA inquiring about the nature of its business selling these illicit substances, you can bet that a team of lawyers is going to respond to that as well as a team of lobbyists.
Do you think that Amazon shareholders are aware of the risks that are being taken?
You know, I don't think so. I don't think that a lot of this reporting has reached wide attention yet, even though some of the anabolic steroids have been pointed out in the past. And I'll wager, while that there are thousands of these sales going on, it's fairly microscopic in the context of Amazon's overall business, and that the risk to the primary Amazon enterprise of selling all sorts of other widgets that are perfectly legal, as well as the books, is not worth it.
Ford Vox, I want to thank you very much for your time and your reporting on this.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Ford Vox, a physician and journalist based at the Shepherd Center in Atlanta, where he cares for people with brain and spinal cord injuries. He also writes for Bloomberg View and The Atlantic, but we found his article, Amazon's Illegal Drug Dealing, on Slate.com. We have a link so you can read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. While some people go to the internet looking for prescription pills, others go to peer into the lives of others. When Word of Mouth continues, we'll visit Opentopia, a disconcertingly engaging website that live streams video from web and security cams across the world. We'll spy on that story after the break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Feeling hemmed in by life in your cubicle? Why not watch someone else's in Russia? Loathe the parking garage? Well, you can spy on one in Japan. Ditto a pool in Spain, a living room in Antibes, or a kestrel's nest in Nebraska. The Opentopia website aggregates live webcams focused on really not much at all. It's kind of a true reality television. Normal-looking people, mundane settings, and completely unscripted. In fact, not much happens at all. So why are people watching? Hannah McBride wrote about Opentopia for Narratively. Hannah, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So what kind of things can one see on Opentopia?
Oh my gosh. There's so many different things. One of my favorites actually is a laundromat, I think, because I spend time at a laundromat, and it's a laundromat in Japan. And everything is red, white, and blue, interestingly. So you just see kids coming in and out, people folding clothes. But you can do restaurants, park benches, intersections are kind of interesting because you can see the traffic come in and out. There's just a whole range of things to see.
I'm just looking at Opentopia right now, and I'm looking at the very laundromat. There's someone sitting down doing some work at a table, just watching the clothes go by. But do they know they're being watched or being seen?
Yeah, that's kind of the interesting part about it. So certain people who have them in their own homes, some of them do know that those are online and they're comfortable with that. But others, it's a little bit of a gray area. And the owner of the website, Fleming Funch, he is very open, Opentopia, very open in that way. If you have any problem with your camera being online, you didn't know that it was on there and you want it to be taken off, he's been very accommodating that way. But most people kind of like it. They get sort of the thrill of this kind of semi-celebrity status. People can see their day-to-day life on the internet.
Tell us more about Fleming Funch, which is not, I'm guessing, a pseudonym. He's actually, what, Danish? I can't recall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is Danish. And yeah, that's his real name. He's a really interesting guy. So he kind of started working on the internet back when things were very open, and the early days of Wikipedia even. So the site actually originally hosted a lot of material that was open source stuff. And then he came across this webcam idea, set it up, and that really took off. It was kind of this sweet spot in the internet's history where people were wanting access to things and not really worrying as much about the kind of privacy implications.
And is his interest just that openness?
Yeah, his interest is that openness. I mean, he really enjoys this sort of social aspect of the internet. He talks a lot about the internet park bench and it would just being a place for people to watch the same thing at the same time. I was speaking to him about sort of where he thought the site could go in the future, and he is interested in having, you know, a camera on a public square in Egypt to see if there's a protest going on. You can tune into that camera and see what's actually happening. So his is much more about being able to explore different places. And I think you sort of, in this industry or in this part of the internet, you take what is available. And what has been available has been a mixture of those things and then other things that you kind of couldn't have predicted. One of the ones he talked about that was really interesting is there used to be a camera that was in an operating room in Russia.
Wow.
And you could see it was meant for medical students, but anyone could see it. And it was like fascinating, but also horrifying.
I guess that was one he was asked to take down.
I should ask him. I don't know if he was asked to take it down or it just sometimes they go offline.
Well, it's so funny because, you know, I remember reading about this program that got really popular, television program that got really popular mm-hmm. in Norway about chopping, burning, stacking wood, and then this kind of like 8 hours of just burning wood. I mean, this is pretty mundane stuff. Is that
right.
what you're talking about when you're talking about this paradox of data availability?
Exactly. Yeah. So that's what was interesting to me. I originally got fascinated by the site just by what you could see, but then also at how normal all of it was. It was like, okay, here's a woman sitting at her computer watching television and like emailing her friends. I've done that many evenings, you know. I don't think it's particularly compelling, but to have that sort of life that's similar in some way, but not being able to actually know the person, not interacting with them, but just watch, is kind of interesting. I think what's different about data availability is how much control people feel they have over it. If you control it and you know that people are watching you, in some ways that's freeing. And I think Susan Dennis, who's one of the main people we interviewed, she said something to that effect. She goes, I know that it's up there. If I want to turn it off, I can. But for the most part, it doesn't bother me that this is out there. I don't have anything to hide, that sort of thing.
Well, I have to say, you know, after initially thinking, wow, what a banal thing to do, I got completely drawn into the botanic gardens in Emilia-Romagna, Italy.
Totally.
There are loads in Russia, offices, mm-hmm. parking lots. So
right.
fascinating to spy. You know, I guess that's what it is. We're actually spying. But how is this different from something like chat roulette, for example, which came and went so quickly because it turned into a sort of cruising or tinged with sexuality kind of tool?
Right. Yeah. So I wrote the story for the site Narratively, and they each week they have a theme. And the theme that I was working with was espionage and surveillance. So I definitely came at Opentopia with that in mind, like, oh, this is spying on people, that sort of thing. But the more I got into it, it is sort of fascinating for people to be able to do something and not be also watched. So you can go and people watch, sit on a bench in a park, but you're part of that scene because other people are also watching you. They could be doing the same thing. And I think what's interesting about it is this one way to do it. I mean, chat roulette is something that they're watching you and you're watching them. So there's still that element of exchange. This is definitely a passive form of observation. So it can't get quite as intimate as quickly. I think you have little control over what you're seeing, but you're just there to witness it.
Well, Hannah, it is absolutely fascinating. I'm certainly hooked. Thank you so much for bringing the story to us.
Yeah, thank you.
Hannah McBride is a freelance writer who reported on Opentopia for Narratively. She also edits for Nowhere magazine. You can find a link to read her article on Opentopia at wordofmouthradio.org. Online phenomena, like the live cam communities we just heard about, have a way of sounding strange and alien to those of us who don't use them. That cultural chasm deepens when online trends suddenly leap into the real world. Like this past weekend, when two preteen girls nearly stabbed one of their peers to death. A terrible crime that was allegedly inspired by an internet urban legend.
According to court documents, Morgan Geiser and Anissa Wire, charged as adults with attempted first-degree intentional homicide, believed they would become agents for a fictional internet character named Slenderman by killing their friend, and then could walk to his proverbial mansion, according to the criminal complaint.
The Slenderman character is usually depicted as tall and faceless and dressed in a black suit, and was created as part of the online genre of horror fiction called creepy pasta. In January, we spoke to the writer Will Wiles, who investigated creepypasta for Eon Magazine. With so many now trying to understand this popular online subculture, we offer this clip to provide a little context for what creepypasta is and why, like the ghost stories of yore, people choose to share it.
Well, it derives from a more general term, copypasta, which just comes from the words copy and paste, meaning any short piece of text or image that is copied and pasted around web forums and shared widely without necessarily being attributed to an author or a point of origin. There are dedicated sites like the Creepypasta Wiki and creepypasta.com. They're also shared on more general forums such as Reddit and 4chan. Scary stories serve a useful social purpose. They let us know which fears we have are commonly held, and we know that other people share our fears, which is, inherently reassuring, even if the telling of the story is very scary. As you mentioned, the campfire is a social experience, not a private one. So, there's always been great value to fright. Retrospectively, it stands to reason that this would be ported into the internet age.
For listeners who've been following the bizarre attack in Wisconsin and seek a fuller understanding of creepypasta, we posted a link to our full interview about the creepypasta genre at wordofmouthradio.org. We hope it offers a little context into a story that's left a lot of people searching for answers. Word of Mouth will be back after a short break.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Among the oft-quoted life philosophies of Rob Gordon, the protagonist of Nick Hornby's novel High Fidelity, is this one. What really matters is what you like, not what you're like. Well, when it comes to social media sites such as Facebook and Twitter, what you like and favorite may be more important than you think. On the Media's sister podcast, TLDR, and producer PJ Vogt brings us the story.
It's a cliche, but it's pretty true. The reason social networks are so boring is because they're where people go so they can pretend to be more interesting and more happy and more photogenic than they really are. Charlie Wurzel writes about the internet for BuzzFeed. He says that despite all this posturing, there's still one last place where, pretty much by accident, we reveal ourselves in an honest way.
You take a lot of time to craft a tweet, or you take a lot of time to craft, a Facebook post or status. But something like a like or a favorite, they're almost more interesting than the actual content being put out on social media.
Obviously, we know that our likes are public, but we usually think of them as just this furtive smile or nod between us and one other person. Charlie's paying attention, though.
I saw two people roughly of the same age, roughly in the media industry, and they were favoriting every little tiny missive and constantly communicating in this sort of below ground sort of way. A few weeks later, I heard these people are dating. So it's sort of like you watch and you can kind of see it play out because people don't think that anyone's watching.
Flirting is maybe the most obvious one, but there's others. Charlie says that he's caught people who are about to leave their job. They started getting suspicious follows and favorites from the new company they were leaving for. And even if you don't catch anybody doing anything scandalous, likes and favorites tell you what someone's paying attention to. And knowing what someone pays attention to could be more revealing than knowing what they choose to say. Of all the social networks, Instagram might be the one that most encourages like voyeurism. You click the following tab and you just get a stream of all the photos your friends have liked.
I don't know. I sort of think of that as sort of the more elite version of using Instagram. It's not about the feed, man. It's about the the following news. Who's liking what? That's what's interesting.
That's Eric M. He has a blog where he catalogs every single Instagram like from one user, a guy that he's never met, but who he feels like he sort of knows.
So why Drake?
I don't know why I started following, but I did. I would start seeing his likes, and they were pretty infrequent. I don't know how other celebrities use it. I shouldn't even call him a celebrity.
If Drake's not a celebrity, who's a celebrity?
It's true, he's a celebrity, but I also think of him, as an artist.
Do you get a different sense of who this guy is from his Instagram likes and from his music?
I think Drake is consistent. His likes are consistent with how he comes across as an artist.
And what is that?
He's tough and tender, you know? And I think a lot of people say he's, like, more tender than he is tough. I think that might be true. He's not just liking pretty girls. He likes family stuff, too. And he posts pictures of his mom.
I'm worried doing this story that there's a large and entirely reasonable part of the world that just says, who the hell cares what pictures a young musician likes on a social network? Why would this matter to anybody? So I asked Charlie.
So I think with something like a like or a favorite, it's like, you know your world's kind of crossed for a second. You really don't get that anywhere else.
No one wants to admit that this moment is valuable, but it kind of is. Alec Baldwin, a celebrity that I have very mixed feelings about, favorited a tweet of mine last month. And the only reason I mentioned that in the story is because I wanted an excuse to brag. My friend Laura Mayer knows a couple who tag Drake in every one of their photos, just on the small chance that they'll steal a moment of his attention. And actually, those stupid, tiny moments of celebrity attention are valuable enough that there's a counterfeit market for them. In the past month, for no discernible reason, the actor Taye Diggs started following a bunch of friends of mine on Twitter. It doesn't matter that most of them aren't House Stella Got Her Groove Back fans. They still felt flattered. For whatever reason, Taye Diggs had chosen them. And then they found out that actually, Taye Diggs has just been rapidly following hundreds of thousands of civilians at random.
I got the Taye Diggs follow.
Really?
I got the Taye Diggs follow, and I was very confused. And then right after, Montel Williams followed me, the talk show guy. And I was like, this is very strange.
Did you have a theory?
Montel's Twitter bio had his, like, the email to the PR guy inside. And I was like, oh, okay, great. So I just emailed the guy, and I was like, hey, what's going on? He called me right away, and he was like, I don't really know what the thing is with Taye Diggs. That's weird. He's like, but Montel is actually following all these people. And, like, he was following this rash of BuzzFeed employees because his wife loves BuzzFeed and sends him links all the time. And he was like, he is, like, this is legitimately him interacting with you. And
do you buy it?
No. So with celebrities, I think you can just tell when someone's being honest. It's getting harder, but it's usually pretty easy to spot, like, a bot. But for someone like Drake, like, it's very clear looking at that his Instagram is, like, an extension of normal Drake. Like, he's sitting there, he's bored like we are, he's killing time in between whatever he's doing, and he's dishing out these, these little notes of approval. And so to look at the whole thing, you kind of hopefully can get this very weird insight into, like, maybe who he is or what he values. As strange as that sounds.
According to Eric's blog, Drake's liked pictures of cute old ladies, cute young kids, one neat sweater, many pictures of himself, a cake with his album cover painted in frosting, and a coconut with his album title branded into it, Richard Branson balancing awkwardly on one leg in front of a jet, a close-up of a manicure where all the fingernails are painted with tiny Drake heads, a man holding a gold bottle of alcohol the size of his adult body while a girl sits on a couch next to him looking very bored. And Eric has stories in his head for each of these, theories about who these people are and what they meant to Drake in that moment. But the best one, the first one, is still a mystery to him.
I don't know if it's someone he knows or just a random person. This little girl and her father at a roller skating rink. And it had like 20 likes. And I have no idea who it was.
This little girl looks terrified. Clearly, she does not want to be on roller skates. Her eyebrows are just two scared diagonals. Her dad's holding her up. He's sort of like hugging her under her armpits. And she's grabbing his hand. He's got that forced smile of a dad who just wants to steal one nice family photo in between tantrums. It's meant to be this tiny lie, and it tells the truth despite itself. I think. Really, we have no idea who the people in this picture are. Drake liked it, though. Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now the whole team here. Started from the bottom, now we're here.
Started from the bottom, now the whole team here. And that story came to us from producer PJ Vogt from the podcast TLDR, which stands for Too Long Didn't Read, in case you were wondering. Started from the bottom, now the whole team here. Yeah, I didn't keep it real from the jump. When Word of Mouth continues, we're going to take a peek into the New England vacation homes of the late 19th and early 20th century and consider what they reveal about attitudes toward family, domesticity, and leisure. That's after the break. I just think it's funny how it goes. Now I'm on a roll. Word of Mouth! This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. an unfinished pine wall, a quiet staircase, a recessed cabinet full of worn china, an empty porch looks out into the wilderness. These are among the images in Tad Pfeffer's book, The Hand of the Small Town Builder, Summer Houses in Northern New England, 1876 to 1930. In it, Pfeffer tours the one-time vacation villages in Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine, photographing historic homes carefully constructed by small crews of local builders. His solitary photographs and carefully researched narrative tell a story of summer life in New England at the turn of the century and what these homes reveal about attitudes toward family, domesticity, and leisure at the time. Tad Pfeffer is a photographer and teacher and a geophysicist based at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Tad Pfeffer, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, as a glaciologist and a geophysicist over there at the University of Colorado, what sparked your interest in the summer homes of northern New England?
There's not really an obvious connection, is there? The connection is because I come from New England. And as a child, I lived in Randolph, New Hampshire, and I'm very familiar with these houses. And from a very early age, as I describe in the book, I've always had a very strong awareness of the effect that houses and the built environment in general have on us as people. And in Randolph, early on in my childhood, my parents would rent a different house every summer. And so I was exposed to several different houses. And it also gave me a way to date my memories because later my parents could tell me, oh, yeah, that house, we were there in, 1957 or something like that. So I could always tell where exactly and when exactly my memories come from. But these houses have really stuck with me for all my life.
So you saw a variety of them. The real explosion, however, in construction in this area was in the late 19th century in northern New England. Why then and why northern New England?
Well, of course, the development of vacation houses occurred somewhat earlier in the South, but not too much earlier. And that was because what we think of as the summer vacation or vacation period really didn't exist prior to mid-late 19th century. Prior to factory jobs and office jobs, it really wasn't possible for one person to leave their work for any period of time, be replaced by somebody else, and then they could take off and do something, unless they were very rich and didn't need to work. And the houses that I describe in this book are very much houses that belonged to people who were not rich. These weren't the same people that were building the so-called cottages in, say, Newport, Rhode Island, or Bar Harbor in Maine. This was done on a much more modest scale. And they tended to be initially a lot of clergy and academics because those were the people that had long summer vacations. Mm-hmm. And one exception to that, I guess, is along the Maine coast where it was actually possible for businessmen in Augusta, say, to have a house out on the coast. And the businessman's family could go out to the coast for the summer and he could join them on weekends. At that time, there was very comprehensive and regular steamer service up and down the rivers and along the coast. So it was possible for somebody who had an office in Augusta to leave Friday afternoon, get on a boat and end up out at Booth Bay Harbor, for example, Friday night.
You photograph these houses without people in them, but there is a sense of lived lives. You know, there are scuffs on the floors or little markings or the wearing of many hands on a doorway.
Yeah.
So we do get a sense of the lives lived there. But tell us more about what these houses reveal about the people who lived in them and built them back then.
I think the main thing that it reveals is what people felt they needed at that time. What they had the means to surround themselves with. The houses are very small, of course, and part of that is economy, no question. But also part of it is people simply didn't have as much paraphernalia to tote around with them as we do today.
And you found that often building these structures were local three-men crews in many cases. Now, how did such small crews manage to build such beautiful homes? I mean, they are smaller cottages than Southwest Harbor or Bar Harbor and Newport, but some of them are quite large and with a lot of interesting architectural detail.
The basic three-man crew at that time consisted of the lead contractor or carpenter making all the decisions and measuring and cutting. Then the second, or sorry, measuring for cutting, and then the second person in that crew would actually be doing the cutting, and then the third person in the crew would be installing the pieces as they were produced. That's what's really remarkable about these houses for me, is that they were, for the most part, designed by the contractor, by the carpenter. This lead person was making the decisions about, which piece to cut and where to put it. They were pretty much universally not trained as architects. They typically didn't have anything beyond a high school education. And of course, that was, fairly normal for that time. College education was not the norm in the late 19th, early 20th century, certainly not in rural parts of New England. And what's really remarkable to me about these people is that for their very limited exposure to the outside world, most of them didn't travel very much, but they were very widely read, and they had a great curiosity about design. They recognized the importance of design, and their clients recognized the importance of design.
We're talking about the summer houses that were built in northern New England between 1876 and 1930. Tad Pfeffer is with us. He's a geophysicist, a teacher, and photographer. He is the author of The Hand of the Small Town Builder, Summer Houses in Northern New England from 1876 to 1930, which is, as you can probably hear, chock full of history that you may not know about some of these summer houses and beautiful, beautiful photographs. Well, talk to us a little bit about John Boothman. It's not easy to find records of all of these small town builders, but John Boothman, who was operating in Randolph, New Hampshire, where you often summered, you learned a lot about him. Tell us a little bit about where he got his ideas and how he expressed them.
John Boothman and his wife were very organized people. They kept careful records, and they hung on to everything. They were pack rats, which I am as well. I use that in a very positive sense of really hanging on to history. So in a few cases, I have not only the photographs of the house, but I have the list of everything that was spent in the construction of the house, how much was spent on labor versus materials, for example, how long it took, and how far the builder's responsibilities went. And this is another very common feature that I'd see throughout New England, is that the builder also very commonly acted as the real estate agent. They would broker the sale of land to build the house on, and they would, in many cases, furnish the house, either buying the furniture and putting it in, or in several cases, they would build the furniture along with the rest of the house. And then in Boothman's case, I can see records of him turning on the water and putting some provisions in the refrigerator just before the summer occupants arrived.
And the houses that he built are just beautiful. And they may have been considered simple then, but summer estates now in New Hampshire, especially if you have a lot of land, have huge tax bills that go along with them. The cost to maintain, can people who were middle class afford these homes anymore?
I think that they can in principle. I think perhaps the larger question is whether they have the time to really take advantage of the second house in anything like the way that people did 100 years ago. When I was a child, we would go up there and spend, 2 months in Randolph. For the most part, that doesn't happen anymore. I mean, even in Randolph, people don't come up there for 2 months anymore unless they're retired. So this uninsulated, really summer-only house, which is occupied for an extended period in the summer, and then the rest of the year, it's just, carefully bundled up, buried in snow, waiting for the next summer to arrive. That's probably gone.
Tad Pfeffer, ending on a kind of bittersweet note, but a beautiful book, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
W. Tad Pfeffer is a geophysicist, a glaciologist, and photographer. He's also a civil engineer at the University of Colorado at Boulder. His new book is called The Hand of the Small Town Builder, Summer Houses in Northern New England from 1876 to 1930. And you can see pictures of some of these spectacular houses that Tad Pfeffer photographed at wordofmouthradio.org. So as we just heard, the era of the simple but gracious vacation homes of northern New England is long over. Now the tiny house movement is gaining popularity in the U.S. With an average floor plan of 100 to 400 square feet, tiny homeowners hope that by shrinking their homes, they can upgrade their lives. Reporter Rebecca Williams takes a peek into some itsy-bitsy homes and brings us this story.
Come on in.
Andrew Bemis lives in a little house on a corner.
Well, here it is. You've just about seen it. You're standing looking at the kitchen. You're in the living room. There's a study. And there's a bathroom behind that wall. And somewhere above the bathroom, there's a bed.
It takes a hop, skip, and a jump to cross from one end to the other. That's because his house is 300 square feet total. Andrew Bemis says a little house is better.
I'm not owned by it, first of all. That's one of the biggest things. I've only got one sink I've got to keep running. I've only got one of anything. Like, I don't have an entire house to take care of. I also leave town a lot, and I don't have to leave an entire house and worry about it.
Bemis is a musician. His love of music explains the 5,000 records lining one wall of his house and taking up precious space. Of course, he also makes room for his banjo. You just don't see tiny houses that much anymore. Some, like Andrew Bemis's, are remnants from the early 20th century. His tiny house is in a sleepy neighborhood that used to be the factory district. He's seen other little houses like his get torn down to build bigger, new ones.
Bigger is better, I guess. Bigger means you've achieved a lot more, but as far as I'm concerned, bigger generally just means that you're working a whole lot harder.
That's one reason people are choosing to live small. They're after a simpler life with less stuff. A smaller house costs less to buy and maintain. And some people argue smaller homes make better use of resources because they just use less of everything. Jay Schaefer says building small is the greenest thing you can do with a new home. He owns the Tumbleweed Tiny House Company. He designs and builds super small houses. He started with his own home. It was really tiny, 70 square feet. That's 7 feet by 10 feet.
It's a huge challenge. It's much harder than designing a large house. There's just no room for error. And if you want to do it well and get the proportioning right, you really have to consider everything as part of everything else.
Schaefer says to live in a tiny house, you have to figure out how much elbow room you need. Turns out 70 square feet was a tad too small for Jay Schaefer. So he traded up to 100 square feet. Schaefer says tiny houses are a tough sell for most Americans, but some people just love small little spaces. Schaefer calls himself a claustrophile. He's built 10 tiny houses and sold dozens more plans. Gregory Johnson is one of Schaefer's converts. He's a computer consultant in Iowa City. He lives in one of Jay Schaefer's high-tech tiny houses. It's just 140 square feet, but with a little bit of magic, one room turns into three.
You know, you can take what was an office, and in about 20 seconds, it converts into a dining area with the sink off to our right, because that's the kitchen.
Gregory Johnson says his tiny house has changed him. He says he had his doubts at first, like the time he visited Jay Schaefer at the construction site.
And he showed me this little hole that I was supposed to crawl through to get into the, it's the passageway up to the upstairs, to the loft. And so I thought, you know, I might have to lose some weight to get up in there.
Johnson says he started really scaling back. He realized if he had a refrigerator, he'd just fill it up with ice cream and pizza, things he really didn't need. So to save energy, he doesn't have a fridge at all. He started eating nuts and grains and fruit. By shrinking his life down to match his house, he lost 100 pounds. Johnson says tiny spaces don't work for everyone. But he says he has a fulfilling life with a whole lot less stuff and space to put it in. Many tiny house owners, such as Andrew Bemis, want their miniature homes to make a statement. Size does matter.
My house is a very small house. It's the littlest house there is. My house is a very small house. It's the littlest house there is. It's bigger than yours. Bigger than yours.
For the Environment Report, I'm Rebecca Williams.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Public Radio. Thank you so much for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there is much more to listen to and to share at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us, you can send us your feedback, and share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. You can join us for more of them Saturday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio. Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.